Okay, let's get started.
Wait, just a minute, partner.
No.
Guess again, freak boy.
To the Batmobile. Let's go.
AudioTU.com. Another fresh picked pod from AudioTU.com. Shutters Inc. with Shelton Muller.
The answers to life, the universe, and everything photographic are here. It is episode 42 of Shutters Inc. This is Bruce Williams, and with me on the line from Melbourne via Skype, as per normal, Shelton Muller. How are you?
G'day, Bruce. I'm really well. How are you?
Man, I'm good.
That's good. That's good. We've had some interesting responses to last week's podcast. I thought we might. It was, you know, and so we should, because I'm a genius, and... you know, people should respond to my genius with accolades, applause, and of course, complete and absolute
and money.
Well, money would be good. Yeah, just send money. I'll give you the bank account details very, very soon. No, but nice to hear from everybody. And Steve, I do apologize for not getting back to you. You ask whether you should go for the D50 or the D70. I'm sure you know the differences between the two cameras. I won't enumerate them just because of time. I only know that I have had experience with both. And in the end, much will depend on, you know, your budget and etc. The D70 is a superior camera, definitely in terms of build and handling, to the D50. But, you know, it is a fair bit more expensive than the D50, and much will depend on your needs. So, look, I won't answer that question straight out, but only to tell you that both cameras produce an excellent result. Some have actually said that the D50 has a better sensor than the D70, but speaking from experience with my wife owning a D70, I know that it's an awesome camera. Good friends owning the D50 know that they also produce excellent images. I really can't answer you much more straightforwardly than that, Steve. And in the end, I think what I'd toss up if I were you is what am I willing to spend and what can I get for that money? Because I'm always suggesting that if you have a limited budget, get the best body you can, but make sure you get a bit of variety with lenses, if that's what you can work with. I know here in Australia, for instance, for around $1,300, you can get the D50. You know, that's $1,300 Australian, the D50 with an 18-55 and a 70-300 Nikkor, you know, something like that.
That's a good range.
It is. And so for that sort of money, you're getting, you know, a great little camera, because the D50 is a great little camera. And you're getting, you know, yeah, an excellent range, 18 through to 300 over two lenses. Mm. So, you know, that's pretty good. The only other thing you might want to consider is a pretty good sort of flash for it, because the Nikon flash system is pretty awesome. So the D50, the D70S, I'm going to leave that to you, but both are excellent cameras. Use them both. Perhaps go into the store, handle them, press the buttons, you know, go through the whole thing and see which one also feels more comfortable to you. And that's the best I can offer you, Steve. And thank you, of course, for ragging me in your email, showing me just how good a picture can be from a mobile phone.
That was a pretty good pick.
It wasn't a bad pick of that little Morgan sports car. Absolutely.
I'll throw that up on the Shutters Inc. page for those that are interested. It was a pick that Steve sent through, taken on a mobile phone camera. And it was pretty good.
It wasn't bad at all. And I'm glad, actually, that has become the case with mobile phones. I have nothing against a phone taking a picture, provided it takes a decent picture. The better the quality of the image that comes out of a phone, hey, I can't argue with that. My problem has always been that, you know, people are accepting these very low-quality images for very important photographs. You know, of their children and of events and things that they do and see and attend. That's just wrong. You know, take a little camera with you that's, you know, got a few megapixels and a good exposure system under its belt. But if your camera takes great photographs, and I'm quite sure it wouldn't do that under, I mean, that picture is in broad sunlight and it's a very colorful subject, etc., etc. So, you know, it's going to be limited. But hey, you know, you got the picture, and that is the most important thing. So good on you, Steve. That's fabulous.
By the way, I don't know if you've had a look at the Shutters Inc. page, but I finally got my photos for the depth of field experiment off my camera. So they're now on the Shutters Inc. page. So when you've got a minute, you can go and have a look at those and let me know either via the podcast or privately what you thought of them.
Well, if it's via the podcast, it means that I'm very proud of you. If it's privately, if next week you people are not hearing anything, then you'll know that Bruce's pictures are crap. I suggest everybody have a look for themselves. And it was a very important experiment, and it has a lot to do with what we're going to talk about today.
Yeah, it was an interesting experiment because I naturally assumed that with my 18 to 70, which at its widest aperture at 18 mil gives me 3.5, I expected it to be quite shallow in the depth of field. But when you compare it with the 300 mil lens at 5.6, which is the widest aperture at 300 mil, the depth of field was just nowhere near it. You know, there was so much more background detail at 18 mil, more than I expected there to be. So that was a good lesson to learn.
It's a vital lesson, I think, and we're going to talk about it again today. It is one of my hobby horses, and we're going to touch on it, but I think it's so important, and if you haven't done it yet, get your girlfriend, your wife, your boyfriend, your kids, somebody who stands still, or something, get a mannequin, whatever, put it somewhere where you've got wide open space, or, you know, and you can, but background detail, like a wooded area, or, you know, something where you've got detail in the background, but it's a fairly open space nonetheless.
Yeah.
And take the photograph, making sure that your subject is the same size and proportion in each picture, but you vary your focal lengths, moving yourself physically to and from your subject so that your subject is the same size in each picture, and vary your focal lengths and vary your depth of field and see what you come up with. And you'll know why portrait photographers use longer lenses and landscape photographers use wider angle, shorter focal length lenses. You know, it tells you in very simple and very straightforward visual terms why, you know, lens choice is important. And we are going to talk about that today as part of our continuation of last week's podcast. Bob, today I'm also going to answer your question. You have been walking around with, as you say, a medium range, or, you know, sort of a 28 to 200 zoom on your Canon, and you want to do some candid photography and some portrait work and that kind of thing. And we have talked about this before. So my suggestion would be go out and get yourself... I live on my Nikon in an 85 1.8 when I'm doing that kind of work. In many of the countries I've traveled in, sometimes I've just put my 85 1.8 on and walked through marketplaces and streets and just done a lot of candid and portrait photography with that one focal length. Being 85 mil, I know, because I'm used to it, and this is something that you mentioned, you're a little uncomfortable with using a fixed focal length lens. I know exactly pretty well now where I have to stand, where I have to be, or what my photograph is going to look like before I raise my camera to my eye, because I'm used to the magnification of the 85 mil lens, because I've used it so much. Like I say, that's where I live usually, and I wouldn't get rid of that lens for anything. If anything ever happened to it, I'd just go out and buy another one. So I have mentioned on these podcasts before that fixed focal length lenses are fabulous. They're great training tools. There's a college here in Melbourne, Photography Studies College, and years ago a friend of mine went there, and all year they were allowed to use an SLR body and a 50 millimeter lens. That's it. They had to do everything with that combination. And boy, did they learn how to see with one lens, so that by the time they were finished with that course, they could move on to other lenses and really understand, you know, how to work with them, because they'd been limited for so long and had yet still achieved some fabulous photographs. You do get used to working with a fixed focal length lens, and the great thing about them is that in the case of, say, the 85 1.8 Nikkor that I use, it's fast. So if you're in a, you know, darkened situation or whatever, you can still get a great photograph, minimal depth of field, which I love for candid street photography and portraits, and of course, you know, available light. It's going to be great. I know now when I've got my 85 mil lens on, and I was thinking about this the other day, shooting a wedding. I set up the bride and groom, and I moved my camera on its tripod a certain distance from the couple, and I'm thinking as I'm walking away from the couple, you know what? I know exactly how far to walk. And I know that, you know, and that's an important thing. I know how far to walk, so that when I turn my camera around, I'm going to frame my couple and I know exactly how big they'll be in the frame. That's how used to using this lens I am. And that's the sort of advantage that you have. When you use a zoom, you get a little bit lazy because you can think, well, here I stand and what I'm going to do, can't fit him in. Well, I'll just go wide. But if we do the experiment that we've suggested in a couple of podcasts ago, you'll find that that's a lazy approach and may not be the best lens to use. I know that the focal length that I've chosen, the 85 mil, is going to be the best for what I have pre-visualized, in my head. And so I walk the distance, I set the camera up, and away we go. Zoom lenses can make us a little bit lazy because we tend to sort of take the picture from where we stand and not use the advantage of telephoto compression by zooming in, or, you know, a wide angle expansion by zooming out. We're just lazy. Oh, I'll fit this in, and we zoom back, and we lose all the dynamics that optics, you know, give us by simply using the wrong focal length on our zoom. Bob, go out, and if you're doing that kind of photography, just get yourself an 85 or a 100 or something along those lines, a good, fast, fixed focal length portrait lens, and get used to that, and you will never ever look back. I hope that answers your question.
What? About 6 or 7 years ago, my whole camera kit got stolen. I had an old, what did they call it? It was the 7000, Minolta 7000i. Mm-hmm. And one of the lenses that I had in that bag, I still miss to this day. It was a 135mm f2.8.
Beautiful focal length.
Yeah, yep. And it was not a zoom. It was a prime lens. And oh God, I still miss that.
Yeah, you're going to have to go out and buy yourself another one, Bruce.
Well, you can't get that lens anymore.
Well, I tell you what, have you heard the news from Sony?
No, probably not. What is it?
Sony are bringing out an Alpha.
Oh, the Alpha I'd heard of, yep.
Yeah, well, that is a they're using all the Minolta compatible lenses. So anything you want for your Minolta now, you can get through Sony, because it's the same lens mount, and they have a whole range of lenses coming out for that DSLR system.
This is why I wasn't that concerned when I heard about Konica Minolta, because I figured this would happen.
Yeah, and it has happened, and it's great news. It really is great news.
Excellent.
So you basically are now able to go out and use that Alpha DSLR lens system, and I'm sure they'll have a fixed focal length lens for you there. I mean, yours is about a 1.5 magnification in comparison with 35mm, isn't it, Bruce?
Yeah, about that.
Yep. So you'd want an 85, you know, or a 90mm, something like that.
That'd be gorgeous.
To get a roughly the same sort of magnification that you were used to with the 135-28, except that you'll have the advantage of maybe having a 1.8 or an F2 or, you know, whatever the Minolta will be. So you've even got, you know, less depth of field again. Using the sweet spot of the lens a little more, so it's going to even be sharper. Ah, you're going to love it. Just go and, you know, just get the credit card out, man. Go and do it. Go and do it.
I do still have my 50mm f1.7, which is a nice lens, but something a touch longer would be nice.
Yeah. I'd seriously consider one of those, because I know you like photographing in Max, your son, and, you know, you love a fixed focal length. Bob, go and do exactly the same thing, mate. That's what I would suggest you do. And that segues beautifully into our actual podcast this week, and that is here we are just raving on answering everybody's questions. But when I talked about the formula last week for dynamic images, you know, the after pre-visualization, if you want to know what I mean by that, download, if you haven't already, episode 20 of Shutters Inc., and I talk about pre-visualization at length there. Let's move on to the next part, which was knowledge of, you know, photography, its technicalities, its technologies, and its accessories is a very, very important thing in achieving an image. And we've just talked about lenses today, and we've gone, you know, quite all through that whole experiment, you know, of focal length versus depth of field versus, you know, compression and expansion. An understanding and of how lenses see is vital to your pre-visualization process. Your first process, your first thing is, of course, the reason why, you know, that which impels you to take a photograph. You see something and you want to take a picture. And so you've pre-visualized it. Now you need to see in your head what lens it's going to be. And this is what I was saying before. When I put on my 85mm, I know exactly what it's going to look like. And I walk the distance so that I'm away from my couple, if a bridal couple or a portrait, and I know pretty well that's about, I've got to stop right here and set up my tripod, and I'm usually accurate within a foot or two at the worst. So that, because I see with that lens, and I've become used to seeing with other lenses, and therein again, and I say again, is the advantage of understanding, you know, your lenses and fixed focal lengths particularly. You really get used to knowing how a lens sees and where you should position yourself, but also knowing what lens to use. You know, do I see this image, you know, wide and expanded, or do I see it compressed and you know, with minimal depth of field, or how do I see it? What lens will I use? That's part of the knowledge process. And every time you put a lens on your camera and zoom in and zoom out, take notice of what it does so that you can you know, form a synaptic pathway that gets in touch with your pre-visualized image that immediately computes that you need such and such a lens at such and such an aperture to achieve the image that sits in the cloudy banks of your creative processes in your mind. Other accessories, apart from lenses, it's important to know. We think these days that, for instance, because it's digital, we don't need filters anymore, but that isn't true. Would you use a polarizing filter, perhaps, in a landscape to deepen the sky, to saturate the landscape, to perhaps remove unwanted reflections from a very wet and moist rainforest? Will you need that? And again, that's part of the knowledge process. How do I overcome the problems that I'm seeing? Because I'm pre-visualizing you're in a rainforest, or a wooded area, and it's moist and wet, and you're getting a lot of reflections, but that's not how I'm seeing it. How do I overcome it? Do I wait for the sun to go behind a cloud? Do I put on a polarizing filter? What do I do to overcome this problem? And of course, every photograph has its problems. It has its issues you need to overcome. So an understanding of all of these combinations of accessories and tools and situations is vital in order to achieve that pre-visualized image. Filters are one of them. Another filter that even digital can require, just to make things simple, is a graduated gray or graduated neutral density filter, so that you can balance out the exposure difference, say, between, you know, foreground and sky. That sort of knowledge is vital. And an understanding of what, you know, now we've talked about lenses and now filters, is important for you to know what the process is, tools-wise, to, you know, get to that image that you see. The same is with flash. I was looking today while waiting too long at a lab for some prints. You know about that, Bruce, because I held you up on this podcast.
That's all right.
And I was looking at the National Geographic Best Pictures of the Year. And there was a photograph there that a man took in some country in Asia, and I don't exactly know where. It's of a mother at dusk bathing her child in a river. And the photographer saw fit to use off-camera flash. So he held the camera with one hand to his eye, he put the flash off-camera in his left hand and outstretched it, and used the flash off-camera to illuminate the subject. And it highlighted her against a very dark, dusky, sort of colorful sky and backdrop, which was beautiful. Now, the photographer knew that was the process he required. He thought, you know, he saw it in his head, and therein was the first thing, and then he knew how to make it happen. And so he's got the right lens, he's got a wide angle lens with her in the foreground and her little one in her arms bathing, and he realizes that in order to make this image work, he's got to have a flash. But he didn't just put the flash on the hot shoe. No, he's held the camera, the flash off camera, in his outstretched left hand and pointed down towards this woman and her child, and it illuminates her beautifully, very naturally actually, against this dusk sky. I thought, well, that's the process. He's got it down pat. And of course, he's a National Geographic photographer, so he should. But he knew that that's what needed to be done to achieve the image. These things take time and they experience. But every time you experiment with something, make a mental note, make a written note if you want to. Look through your photographs and say, you know, and understand what you've done to achieve each image.
At the very least, go back and look at your EXIF data later.
Yes, that's a
good
idea.
Because all that stuff's going to be there.
Yep. What lens you've used, what flash, what exposure, what depth of field or aperture, what shutter speed, all those things, yes, are very important. Let's not discount them, because they are the technologies and the technicalities in photography, but they are just as much a part of the art of photography as is composition. You know, we think everything's composition. It's not true. Composition is one small part, an important part, but just a small part of the process of creating an image. So a friend of mine, when I was just a teenager and he was teaching me photography, he said, everybody makes the mistake of going through their photographs and learning from their mistakes. He said, don't do that. Go through your pictures, pick out the good ones, and learn from your successes. That way you'll repeat them. And I think that was the best piece of advice I could have been given at that time, because it did teach me. When I looked at a photograph and I thought, wow, what did I do right there? Well, this, and this. And every time I was in a similar situation, I remembered what I had done right, rather than concentrating on the mistakes I made, because I don't want to remember those. You know, I want to get rid of them. I want to concentrate on my successes. So it was a great way of learning. Another thing that's part of this knowledge process is metering and exposure. This photographer, for instance, that I was just speaking of in this image, he set his camera manually and set the exposure so that he wouldn't overexpose the background. Knowing that it was dark, he realized that perhaps his camera would try to overexpose to compensate. But he realized it was dusk, he wanted a dark sky, and he was going to illuminate his subject with a flash anyway. So he set his camera manually, and off he went. The camera had an exposure set, and he then used the flash to illuminate from the side, from off to his left-hand side, the subject. Now, that is an understanding of metering and exposure, and is just as much a part of the pre-visualization process as any of the things that we have spoken about. Metering is vital. An understanding of how exposure will affect your photograph is vital. And don't always use your camera on automatic. Understand that it has its limitations, it has its own way of seeing, and it may differ from the way you see. So as part of this knowledge process, get a combination of combinations together, so that you know that when you change this, this will happen. When you alter that, this will happen. When you add this, this will happen. And it's sort of like this a slide rule of combinations in your mind, that the moment you alter one thing, you understand how it's going to affect the other. And after a while of shooting, all those combinations, like a computer program, just instinctively enter into your process of creating the image. This second process, this knowledge process, we cannot understate or underestimate. In a world where we build everything to, you know, make it easy, it sometimes actually takes the process away from us, which, yeah, sort of takes a little bit of the satisfaction away from us, but also takes away the individuality of the process away from us, and doesn't always get it right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, understanding all of these things and putting them, you know, into your own sort of software in your head, so that you understand, you know, the variables and how one thing, the yin and yang of it all, as it were, is vital in the second step of our dynamic images formula, which, as I say, dynamic images equals, you know, knowledge plus pre-visualization plus knowledge plus patience plus equipment. And so over the next couple of weeks, we're going to talk about those other steps, so that we really, by the time we've rounded this out, you have a full understanding of that formula. And as I said in last week's podcast, it is the formula that I work with whenever I'm out shooting. I got an email from Andy Garcia. Now, I don't think it's the Andy Garcia, because this Andy Garcia lives in Florida, and I presume the other, uglier Andy Garcia lives in LA. That's what I'm presuming. But if, Andy, you are the Andy Garcia, I'm sorry about the ugly crack, all right? But Andy, thank you for your compliments on that formula. It is a great formula to use. I have, you know, like I said, employed it in my photography, and suggest that when you go out shooting, even if you've got to write it on something, remember that that's the process, the one I've used successfully. And if, you know, if an idiot like me can get it right on that formula, anybody can. So give that a try. Next week, of course, we're going to talk about the next part of the process, which is patience. Now, sometimes you haven't got time to be patient. You grab the shot. But we're going to talk about why patience is such an important part of this dynamic images formula. So stay tuned and come back to us this time next week.
Fantastic. Now, this photograph that you've been talking about today, this National mm-hmm. Geographic shot, mm-hmm. did you see that online, or were you seeing it in the magazine? Or?
No, it was in the book. I think it's 100 or the great best pictures of the year, and it was sitting okay. on a table in the lab I was in. I wonder if I can find it somewhere, but it was just a great image of you know, this mother bathing her child with, you know, the flash, and I thought, wow, that's really great. You know, that's a fabulous shot, and this photographer has known. He's gone in. He's used this whole pre-visualization plus knowledge process, and he's bagged the shot. He's got it absolutely spot on. He saw it and he achieved it. That's the key, you know, seeing it and achieving it is
the key.
Did you
happen to see the name of the photographer?
Mate, I didn't realize I was going to be talking about it so much on this podcast. I would have made more note.
I'm going to try and track it down, because it's bound to be on the web somewhere.
Yeah.
And if I can find a link to it, I'll put it on the Shutterzinc page.
I'll do the same thing.
All right, cool.
And I'll see if I can find it, and we'll you know, yeah, see if we can put it on the podcast to study. It is a great example of how a photographer has used his creative ability and an understanding and a knowledge of the technicalities of photography to achieve a piece of art and a social comment image. Beautiful, beautiful process and a beautiful image to result.
Fantastic. Okay, one last thing I wanted to mention before we went is something I saw on Gizmodo yesterday, and that is this thing called the Gorilla Pod.
Mm-hmm.
You've heard of these, Shelton,
because
you were telling me in an email it's going to be in Total Image in the next issue.
Yes.
For anyone who hasn't seen this thing, I'll put the link up on the Shutterzing page. This thing is fantastic. It's one of those things that you look at it and you go, why didn't someone think of this sooner? And it's basically got flexible legs for this tripod, so you can wrap it around the branch of a tree or whatever to give yourself a stable platform. I think they're awesome.
And, you know, it's great, you know, if you go to the website, it shows it using a little compact digital camera and that kind of thing. However, now here's another idea. It's great, of course, as a tripod for a little camera, but it's also great if you want to put your flash on something and use either sync cord or wireless flash.
Nice. What
a I mean, you put it on a branch, you put it on a post, you put it on something, and you've got it connected. You don't have to get someone to stand there or whatever. You can put your flash. So you just buy a little flash shoe that goes on top of the tripod mount, and bang, you can use that to, you know, for all sorts of things apart from holding your camera. I want one. I'm going to get one.
Sweet. Anyway, we'll definitely have to look at trying to get one or two to give away or something like that.
Have to have some competition or something, won't we?
Definitely. Okay, matey, thank you for all of that.
Thank you.
And we'll talk with you next week.
Looking forward to it, mate. Take care.
See ya.
Bye.
You've been listening to another Fresh Picked Pod from audiotou.com. Audio to You delivers the best quality podcasts direct to your desktop or portable.
You be the boss.
Hear what you want to hear
when you want to hear it.
Hey, now that's a good idea.
audiotou.com. Hit us today.
And remember,
Control V to bookmark
audiotou.com.